Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
And that third, very deep voice was
Cliff Sarin. I'm the technical editor of Computer Weekly.
Cliff's going to talk about a few things. He's going to talk about the end of life for Windows 7, which we touched on last week.
Yeah, briefly.
What it means for CIOs. Claire is missing this week. She's probably on a plane just now.
Yep, she's coming back from Barcelona. She's been at an international airlines group event about kind of diversity and inclusion type stuff. So I'm sure she'll be back next week to tell us all about it.
Yeah, we'll find out about that next week. Caroline, you're going to give us a bit of an update about IR35.
Yeah, there's been a lot happening in that over the last couple of weeks, and there will be more as well over the coming weeks as well. So.
And then about AWS and the Six Nations Rugby Tournament, which is about to begin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about data literacy and the lack thereof among workers in the UK. We're going to close out the podcast with some reflections on Davos, which Cliff has written about. But first, we'll start with Windows 7. Cliff, why does this matter to CIOs?
Why does it matter to CIOs? They've had 5 years to get off Windows 7, because Windows 10 has been around for, 5 years.
Since 2015, it's been around.
Yes, from 2015. And when Windows 10 was released, the clock starts ticking for end of support. And Microsoft said, you've got until January the 14th, 2020. Now that day has gone by. Yeah, Windows 7 is no longer supported. But on the day that they did that was the last patch Tuesday. That meant that after January the 14th, there wouldn't be any more patches, but there was one last patch, and it had some critical updates. That was a thing. And one of those was one that you had to fix for Windows 7, or a couple of them were for Windows 7. Now, my concern about this patch Tuesday thing and for Windows 7 is that people do have to get off the operating system. There will continue to be patch Tuesdays. These will be patches for Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
But as everyone knows, Windows is a sort of compatible operating system. Stuff that's on Windows 7 can run on Windows 10.
Yeah.
So now, a lot of the core operating system, I'm not speaking out of turn here, is probably based on the same core technology, core kernel. Now, what's to say that a hole in Windows 10 that gets fixed on a patch Tuesday remains unpatched on Windows 7, and there will be a lot of people still using Windows 7, because it takes a long time to get off the operating system. Even though people have had 5 years, there are some organisations that are still in that process of upgrading.
Yeah.
One example being the National Health, NHS.
Mm-hmm.
They have embedded systems. They have things like CAT scanners, X-ray machines that run embedded versions of Windows.
Yeah.
And these systems can't just simply be upgraded. You've got to rely on the manufacturer to put the new software on there. Or in this case, these are life-critical systems.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to wait for a new machine to come along. Mm. That may take many, many years.
Yeah.
So some of these systems simply will not be upgraded very quickly.
Mm. I was struck by the fact in one of your blog posts, Don't Cry For Me, about the sheer percentage of radiology departments that still run on or will be running on Windows 7.
Well, the reason is because these machines that are made by the likes of Siemens and Philips and GE Healthcare, for instance.
Yeah.
These manufacturers are producing state-of-the-art machines, but they don't upgrade them. It's not like a PC. These things just don't get upgraded every year. They have to perform a function for the hospital. And my argument is this: if you are, it's very hard to justify having a new operating system. I love Windows 7. It's a great operating system. It took me a long time. It took me a long time to get off Windows 7. In fact, just over Christmas at the time, I upgraded my last two machines. Me, the multi-device person, last two machines left in the house, were upgraded from Windows 7 to Windows 10. But there was no reason to do so. The only reason is because the new operating system, Windows 10, which is now 5 years old, it's not a new operating system, is actually... I had to be off it because I didn't want to be on an unsupported PC, and it's simple as that. And I think what you'll find with IT departments is that they will upgrade, but it's going to take them a long time to refresh the PC. So we've got figures showing that maybe you know, there's still 20%, 30% of organisations or desktops that and laptops that are not being upgraded yet. They haven't been upgraded yet. And one thing that is out there that, you know, that people should be aware of is that if you start today and you phone up Dell or you phone up HP and say, right, I need 100 new PCs, it's very likely that you're not going to get that order in because there's a shortage of processors, processors.
Yeah, yeah.
And that may mean that you're not going to be the first one to, you know, if you're a large organisation, you would have put that order in a year ago.
Yeah.
And the channel will make sure that those PCs are fulfilled. But if you've come to them today saying, well, I've got 20 laptops or 10 laptops, and I forgot that these ones need to be upgraded, they're getting old. An old PC can run Windows 10. I mean, my mum's got an old PC that is so old, you know, 10, 12 years old, and it just about runs it, just about. But it's so unreliable, right? So the last thing an IT department wants to do is install, spend the time and effort and money installing new software, Windows 10, on an old piece of hardware. It's just, you know, it's not a cost-effective thing to do because that PC will not function very well. It's likely to be a support headache. Ideally, you give the users a new Windows desktop and it has, you know, it's a brand new machine, it's more reliable, and it has, you know, a new operating system. The problem is that I think there's this thing. You can't actually get the machines quick enough, particularly if you're doing a large order.
But the growth of cloud computing is changing the picture for CIOs anyway, isn't it, in terms of how they refresh their desktop estates?
Yes, I mean, I'm a big fan of the idea of desktop as a service. If you think about it, we, as users, end users, use multiple devices, you know, Android, iOS, you have a Windows desktop, you might have a Mac, you know, you have a whole load of different things going on at the same time. Let's take a classic application, Office 365. It is available on all of those platforms. Your SaaS application, say you're using CRM, maybe you use Salesforce, the most popular SaaS application, you know, is CRM application.
Yeah.
That's available on all these platforms. So why then do you need your Windows desktop, you know, to be tied to your Windows desktop? So the idea of desktop as a service is that you can run many applications in the cloud, and for the ones that maybe are just Windows only, that can be run, say, on an AWS cloud or a Google cloud, and all you're accessing is the user interface. And the interesting thing about this is that you can access that user interface on any device. So you can get Windows on an iPhone, you know, and I've seen it, you know, you can get Windows on an Android phone. It might look crap, but it's there.
Yeah.
Well, what about getting rid of Windows entirely and moving to some other...
I've tried. Personally, I'm a Chromebook user, big fan, and their big sort of, their USP is that, you know, this thing boots up instantly, doesn't really have any security issues. Who knows? I mean, this is today. You know, five to 10 years ago, Apple claimed that Mac OS was the most secure operating system, but it isn't. It's just giving someone a target. There are alternatives, but the problem is Windows has been around for a very long time, and there are applications that only run on Windows. If you look at local authorities, they have tons of stuff that cannot simply be moved onto a different operating system or even become browser-based. But over time, you know, you'll see, for instance, you know, we know that, you know, Salesforce is the biggest CRM package. So when people are buying into CRM, they are looking at, well, it's going to be a SaaS-based solution. You wouldn't buy something that runs on a desktop. Your HR software tends to be browser based, or, you know, a SaaS solution. Why would you install something on your desktop? And, you know, we're going down that route now.
It's a different paradigm.
It definitely is.
Now, before there was a Windows 7, there were stories in Computer Weekly about IR35.
Yes.
And those stories continue, Karen.
Yes. There is the IR35 reforms. So it's, I think it's over 20 years old now, the original IR35 legislation. And over the years, there's been a series of tweaks to it, and basically on HMRC's behalf to try and clamp down on tax avoidance within the freelance and contractor space. So the latest one of these changes is coming into force in April 2020, which is when private sector organisations are going to assume responsibility for determining how the contractors they engage with should be taxed. So should they be taxed in the same way as permanent salaried employees, i.e. inside IR35, or should they be taxed as off-payroll freelance workers? So if you're an inside IR35 contractor, that means you have to pay employment tax, whereas if you're outside IR35, you don't. So inside IR35, you're paying the same tax as a regular employee, a permanent employee would, but you don't get any employee benefits. So you don't get sick pay, paid holiday, and you don't get like pension either. Basically, up to now, it's been up to the contractors to say, like, oh, I think the work I do and the way I work means I'm outside IR35, so I don't need to pay employment taxes.
Yeah.
And the trade-off's been, you know, you don't pay tax, but then you don't get holiday or sick pay either. By putting the onus on medium to large enterprises to determine how contractors should be taxed, suddenly there's this huge administrative burden that a lot of enterprises are finding themselves having to do, because they have to individually assess every single contractor that they work with.
Yeah.
So in some cases, as we're seeing right now, as companies are starting to face up to the fact that, okay, we need to make all these determinations by April 2020, a lot of them are really panicking and making, I would say, quite rash decisions on all of this. You know, what's the easiest way to kind of get over this? Just get rid of all your contractors, which is what a lot of firms are doing. So rather than having to individually assess tax dates of each one, they're just saying, you know what, we just won't employ any contractors anymore. So they're giving them choices. They're saying instead you can continue working here on sort of two conditions. Either you take an inside IR35 contract and you can stay here.
Yeah.
Or you carry on working for us but via an umbrella company. Yeah, not through a limited company anymore.
Okay.
So you have to go through one of those routes and you can't, we're not entertaining any outside IR35. So this is causing quite a degree of upset amongst the very vocal IT contractor community.
And there's a call for delay?
There is. There's calls for delay. There's been calls for it to be scrapped completely. And there are a lot of concerns being talked about at the moment from contractors, from campaign groups, from the recruitment industry this week as well. But there's a feeling that the government really hasn't got a handle on what the economic fallout from all these changes is likely to be. In some cases, if we can't find work, they're going to have to they're saying they're going to bench themselves, so they'll just sit out for the next 6 months to a year, just won't do any work, because they don't want to sort of get caught up in any of this. To avoid any of the fallout from IR35, they're just saying, you know, we won't take on new contracts. We've got enough money saved in our limited companies that we can afford to just take some time out. So you're losing those skills from, like IT skills from the economy for the time being while they wait out to see what happens. So the reason they're opting to bench themselves is there is this hope that eventually when organisations sort of see like the impact of like getting rid of their contractors, that they might sort of roll back their decisions.
Yeah,
right. And then rehire them.
Yeah.
So the idea is that like, if they take some time out now, they will be poised and ready for when these enterprises that have decided to get rid of their contractors come to their senses and they can just jump back in. Because if you close down your limited company, you can't start another one up for another 2 years.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you know, you could get around that by going down the umbrella route, but in the interim. But for a lot of people, it's quite a big risk to think, right, okay, I'll shut down my limited company in the hope I keep my job. So some people are sitting it out for that reason, if they can afford to. But not everyone can. Obviously, some people, well, everyone's got financial commitments, mortgages, families, whatever. We are hearing lots from contractors saying they are going to walk off projects, they are going to leave at the end of February. That seems to be the key time at the moment that everyone's saying they're going to up sticks and go.
Yes.
But at the same time, not everyone's going to be able to do that. And some people might just think, okay, well, I'll go inside IR35 and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a concern if you do that and you've previously been working outside IR35, if you suddenly sort of say, okay, yeah, fine, I'll come in inside IR35, HMRC might look at you and think, okay, so previously you've told us that the work you do is outside IR35 and you've not paid us any tax.
Oh my God.
So now your employer has said you're inside.
You.
So
yeah.
could that result in another retrospective tax grab by HMRC?
It does seem very disruptive. I mean, I suppose from a business point of view, you could say, well, you know, why am I paying all this money for generic project management skills when I could be paying someone on a PTYE basis much less? But there is an argument, isn't there, Caroline, that you know, these are not just generic IT skills, they're quite specialist skills that these guys have built up through their companies over 20 years or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that there is, some of the people you talk to say, you know, not everyone is completely anti-IR35. In terms of the reform, some people say actually it could work really well because there are definitely jobs within IT jobs within certain companies that should be inside IR35 and could be done by someone who works there permanently, like say first line support, sort of IT support over the phone. They are employ people on a contractor basis to do that. There'll be hundreds of people doing the same job and you come in, week out and just do that kind of work. So it's hoping that it could clamp down on areas where there is, you know, sort of tax avoidance going on and sort of do a clean sweep through companies and bring in compliance that way. But for a lot of organisations or a lot of individuals who are, you know, abiding by the rules, they've worked very hard to ensure that the work they do is outside IR35 and they've kept a very clean sheet with all of this. They are feeling quite persecuted by the whole thing, I think.
Cliff, you've been around Computer Weekly for a wee while.
I have.
Any views on this kerfuffle?
It's been a story we've been writing for many years, as you say. Yeah, I mean, just as you know, the sort of people that I would speak to, the software development on the software development side, there's, I mean, along with support, there's a raft of skills that, I mean, like today, for instance, you can't hire internally, get sort of AI and data scientists, as you know. So these people are out there in sort of contractor land and they have to be hired in. And that's always been the case in IT. If you want a real specialist skill, you would go out and find a contractor to do it. It's the way the big consultancies work. They would backfill certain roles with contractors. I mean, a good friend of mine, I mean, used to do this on an HR system. He had his own limited company. He was hired by one of the big SIs as a sort of freelance, as a contractor, to do a big project for a customer. You know, and it's been a standard thing for many, many years.
And there are concerns that this could pave the way, and this is like proper doom mongering now, this could pave the way for kind of like no rights employees within organisations.
Okay.
So over time, organisations might kind of thin out their workforce, generally permanent employees. So a company might say make them redundant and then over time, once enough time has passed, re-employ people on an inside IR35 contract to do the same thing. And they'll pay the same employment taxes, but they won't have to give them any employee rights.
Brexit Britain.
Yeah, so there'll be no... So, yeah, so you'll have people who are... You know, this will lead to more zero-hour contracts and that kind of way of working. It's something lots of people keep repeating to me in the phone calls I'm doing with contractors on this, but I'm hoping there are, like, laws to prevent companies doing that, but you don't know, you know, with... We're going to be out of the EU soon, so a lot of our protection might disappear on that one.
Caroline, as well as being our resident tax expert, you're also our authority on all matters AWS.
Yes.
And cloud, right. Of course, more generally. And that's been the source of some light, sporty relief and a bit of celebrity interviewing this week.
Yeah, I was at the official launch of the Guinness Six Nations Championship at the Tobacco Docks this week.
It used to be the RBS.
Oh, did it?
Nations Championship.
Oh, okay. Yes. I thought you meant that used to be their offices or something. It's like, it's absolutely freezing in there. It's like a it's a pretty nice building, but it's like a glorified greenhouse. But yeah, I was there at the launch of this, not in a personal capacity, because I know flip all about rugby. I used to pretend I did when I was at university, because I was at university in Leicester, so we had Leicester Tigers.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
you'd go up. So yeah, so you'd be like, yeah, I'm a rugby fan, because it meant you'd go out drinking sort of like before midday. To go and watch a match.
So that involved a lot of intensive Wikipedia activity before games.
Well, I'll show my age, but Wikipedia wasn't really a thing back then. But it's just like, if you shout loud enough and you've drunk enough, you fit right in. So it's all fine. But yeah, Amazon Web Services are the official tech partner for the championship. And they basically asked me along because they wanted to show off all the amazing machine learning wizardry that they're bringing to this year's championship, which is designed to kind of enhance the viewing experience for people who can't make it along to the games and are watching all the action from home or possibly from the pub somewhere. Using their tool SageMaker, which is like a managed kind of machine learning service that helps you train and create and machine learning models and stuff like that to create these sort of stats that will appear during the game on screen so that people can kind of keep up with the action and stuff like that. But a lot of it, as they were sort of telling me at the show, a lot of these stats are sort of, they're able to provide insights into the game that were previously just not possible.
Mm.
So sort of thing, they were talking about rocking. So apparently that has previously been kind of like a bit of the game where it's quite hard to get any sort of transparency on what's actually going on when all the players are sort of piled in over the ball.
It's a brittle game.
Yeah, so they've got heat maps, so you can sort of track.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, so you can sort of see who's actually got the most possession in that.
Right.
So stuff like that to sort of open up bits of the game that like, might be hard if you're not there right, you know, on the side of the pitch watching. So things like that. And also just some other bits as well, which sort of to make the game a bit more interactive. So when someone goes to do a penalty kick, they'll have a sort of prediction come up on screen saying how likely is it that this person will score based on sort of stuff that's gone on in the game in that moment in real time, but also based on sort of historic data about like the health of the player, you know, previously when they've done similar kicks like this, have they scored and stuff like that. So yeah, so they were sort of they were telling me all about this. It's the second year they've worked with the championship. But I ended up chatting at the event to ex-England rugby captain Will Carling,
who's now famous captain of England.
Yes, who is also moonlighting as like a tech ambassador, I guess, for AWS. And he's very pro all these new stats and sort of ways of interacting with the game being created by Amazon, as you would expect. But yeah, he thinks it's really useful for a couple of reasons. One of them is that it will help to demystify parts of the gameplay, as we talked about, but also help the people at home maybe make a better sense of like why one team is winning over the other. Like, what exactly is it about the way they're playing that means they're winning? You might not be able to see that from home. And he said, you know, it'll start conversations amongst people. Oh, you know, this player's better because of like data that we've got. So he was saying, oh, you know, data makes heroes in this game now, because by having access to all
data,
the
data makes heroes.
Yeah, that's what he said. Mm. You know, he sort of used the thing that, you know, his kids, when they're talking about games, they can use this data to sort of say, oh, you know, we can tell who was the best player on the pitch that day. It'd be this guy or, you know, or this girl, because women's rugby is the fastest growing part of the sport now. So, so he was sort of making the point as well. It's going to boost engagement for people who are proper super nerdy rugby fans, but also maybe newcomers to the game who maybe get pulled in to sort of a big championship but don't know a lot about it. So it'll kind of pull them in as well and hopefully get like younger players, like kids involved. It's, you know, very interactive, a lot to look at, and and also boost take up and participation with like, more women entering the game as well.
That sounds cool.
Yeah,
it did used to be called the RBS,
yes,
Six Nations, and because I remember a few years ago doing a similar kind of story. Accenture was then.
Yeah, I was going to say that's who AWS took over from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and they were also brought in Click and Alteryx and Tableau.
Oh.
The great enemy of Click.
Oh.
So they had all that. And they were kind of using it. It was an Accenture data scientist who were working on the project. And they also had some rugby guys, a couple of ex-England players.
Mm.
And an ex-coach involved in doing the analytics and stuff.
Mm.
But this, like the heat map thing sounds like an advance to me. And I'm sure things have come on a lot over the last few years as well.
Yeah, I mean, they said when they started out last year, I think there was 7 new stats and metrics that they were bringing on screen.
Completely new metrics.
Yeah, and now they've expanded that by a further 5, which you can read all about in the story. I probably will start highlighting my lack of rugby knowledge if I start trying to talk through those. You know, what you can do with data and the insights you can glean from this are obviously increasing every year. And I guess also just based on feedback from people, like what kind of stats on screen do they engage with? Which ones, I guess, do they just find a distraction and don't add anything to the game? As well, I did ask him as well about if any of this is sort of, you know, having access to his data, is it likely to sort of change how sort of the training of players is undertaken or any of the coaching stuff, sort of drawing on a little bit from the Gareth Southgate tech ambassador interview thing we did the other week with Google Cloud.
Yeah,
he was kind of like, you know, a similar story really. Technology and data in the training of players is pretty pervasive sort of championship level, national level.
Yeah.
But he is hoping, you know, as time goes on, seeing what is possible will mean it will trickle down to sort of lower leagues, club level as well, where it's less sort of common at the moment.
Well, he was a hugely successful captain of England.
Wasn't he one of the youngest?
Afraid to say.
Or like 22, I think. I did actually look him up on Wikipedia as a link. Yeah, I looked him up on Wikipedia before I interviewed him.
Joys of Wikipedia.
I think one of the stats was, he was like the youngest England captain at 22.
He was 22, yeah. He'd just come out of the army. But it's great to hear that he's such an evangelist for data, because yeah. data literacy is an area I discovered this week. Well, hardly discovered.
How long have you been working
here?
Just an amazing thing I never knew before. Where the UK could do a lot better. This is a story based around a survey, which I'm going to come back to in a wee bit. It was a survey basically sponsored by Accenture
and
Click through this thing that they're both involved in called the Data Literacy Project, which is a thing that Click set up in 2018 and where we could all go and get certified in various kind of competencies regarding data literacy. The report's called The Human Impact of Data Literacy. And the research was done by, I think, an organisation called Opinium. It was done in September of last year among 9,000 workers of various levels, up to CEO, etc. So very kind of wide spread of people and a wide spread of geographies and so on. So I was speaking to James Fisher, who's the Chief Product Officer at Click. James I've known for a while. He's been around the business intelligence game for about 20-odd years. And one of the things he picked out was that 37% of the respondents trust decisions more when they're based on data. So think about that for a minute. That means 63% don't think data is all that it's cracked up to be when it comes to business decisions. So all the work that my guys, data scientists, have done, and not just data scientists, but data warehouse managers and data architects, etc. All that work, why do they bother? If at the end of the day, business users are saying, well, it's nice, but we don't trust it any more necessarily when it comes to making our decisions. And that was the thing that he really picked out, which I think is interesting. But the thing that we kind of talked about was the kind of psychological unease that a lot of workers, like ourselves, have when we're confronted with data, a data project, a data task. And typically what you do is you put it off. You procrastinate. And they reckon like one day a week has been lost
to procrastination.
Because people are not getting down to crunching the data and analysing the data and use all these tools they've got, whether it's Click or Tableau or just Excel spreadsheets or Alteryx, which I mentioned a couple of minutes ago as well. They're not using them, or they're putting off the tasks, which is quite kind of interesting. I mean, obviously what they're trying to do is get more people to do this kind of work and do it a bit more intensively, and I suppose cynically using some of the tools.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Those tools are not, I mean, as the guy who writes a lot about licensing, this stuff isn't cheap. And I think there was a Gartner stat a couple of years ago that just basically saying everyone should be a data person and have access to tools. Consumerization of data, for want of a better word, it's, that would be fine if this stuff was really cheap or free, but it isn't. It's really expensive. Per desktop, per user would be incredibly expensive.
I know, but you get what you pay for. Data is the new oil. Think of all those business opportunities that are being squandered because people can't really be bothered to get down to work and crunch this stuff.
But it's also going back to this, what you were saying earlier, with was it 67% that don't believe the data?
Well, it's 37% trust decisions more when based on data. Only 37%.
Yeah, so, I mean that means that the 63% or so who don't trust the data, I mean, there is something that I haven't got to the bottom of, but data models don't always reflect everything that and somehow there's that sort of, well, what about this sort of the gut reaction, intuition side of thing, and there's something that isn't modelled in the data, but it's so important that somehow, well, I mean, I interviewed this is where I can say I interviewed the CTO of Mercedes Petrona, the Formula One team, the world champion, and I actually asked him about Lewis Hamilton, and I said, well, you know, when it comes to it, is Lewis going to trust the data or is he going to trust his instinct?
Yeah.
Actually, we know the answer to that, you know.
He's going to trust the data.
It's going to go.
It's going to, yeah.
The problem is, and this is it, for, you know, top teams, sports teams, from whoever, you know, the top performing companies, whatever, is that you can only measure so many things.
Mm.
You're not measuring every single possible thing that is out there.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Formula One car, they just don't have enough data coming from there. And, you know, what Lewis Hamilton sees and feels is something that can't easily be modelled.
Yeah.
And
that's true for business people making business decisions as well. But even so, it would be better if a bit more data was involved and was trusted more than is the case, clearly, at the moment.
But do you think part of it as well is that, yes, people have got all these tools and they've been told, right, you can open up loads more business opportunities by delving into this data, but it's one of the reasons they're not, is just they don't see the value in it. I mean, like, speaking from personal experience, if I know, like, a work task, not necessarily data related,
yes,
but I think, oh, this is going to be worthwhile me doing, this is going to get like loads of hits on the Computer Weekly website,
sure,
I will crack on and do it. Whereas if there's like boring admin-y bits, I'm just, I don't see the point in doing this, I always put it off. So maybe they don't see the value in data as much as like it's being hyped.
Very good point. Well, I suppose what is kind of being suggested here in this report is that is because people aren't sufficiently educated to understand and appreciate the value of data.
So my admin.
If only they were. I tried to get James to say that in the UK we are especially bad, because that's a nice headline. He wasn't really willing to play with me on that. But if you look at the figures in the report, there's an interesting thing about people who feel that education, mainstream education, what they learned in school and university, whether it equips them to deal with data as business people, like, or not. And only 10% of the UK respondents said that their formal education had equipped them to get the value out of data. The US figure was 17%, so still below 20%, still not that great, but more than us. And 19% of the Japanese said that their education system had taught them enough about data literacy for them to then get the most out of data, which is possibly a little bit concerning. And we do tend to drop maths pretty quickly.
Yeah, as soon as possible.
Yeah. In England, I think you guys, you can drop it at 16, can't you?
You don't have to carry it on. Yeah, you don't have to carry it on.
It's very different in Scotland. We have to continue with maths to higher and so on and so forth. But, you know, England, well, what can I say?
He needs to know how to count.
Yeah, well, one interesting thing James said to me, though, which I'm still trying to get my head around, is not just about statistics. Data literacy is about lots of other things too, arguing about data, being able to have an intelligent conversation about it. And he kept saying, it's not about training people to use a technology. It has to be about more than that. But finally, this is a survey story, and I hate survey stories. Generally speaking, I don't like doing them and avoid them. But on the other hand, we do publish a lot of them.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
sometimes
yeah.
it saves my bacon when I come to bring the News Digest together for the easing version of Computer Weekly. I'm pretty reliant on a couple of survey stories.
But then this one sounds like it's quite a nice sample size, which isn't always the case when I'm discounting.
9,000 is not
bad. Yeah, when I'm discounting a survey story, I'm like, they asked 5 people in a straw poll? No, thank you.
But they're always going to be aligned with whatever the sponsoring technology.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah,
my massive pinch of salt.
Yeah, that's
to be taken with
pretty much
stories.
My standard line to PRs when they phone up and ask, "Are we going to cover their survey stories?" Like, you know, you're a data backup company, and the end point of this is that people aren't buying enough data backup, and the quote in it is sort of talking about all the catastrophes that will happen if people don't buy more data backup. I'm not covering it. Like, go away.
From data to Davos,
Davos. Very good.
You were our man covering Davos, as you have done in previous years.
And I've done it from safely from London, and the greediest way to
One of my questions, why do we as Computer Weekly never get invited to Davos?
What happens, well, the
BBC are there.
We and along with the national newspapers and the national magazines generally get invited to an event a week before Davos, where the World Economic Forum release a survey and some data.
A lot more credible than vendor surveys, I'm sure.
It's called the Global Risk Report, and it sort of sets out what the world leaders and business leaders think is going to be the big risks, you know, that need to be addressed and we should all be aware of. In the past, you would know this. There's the sort of, you know, terrorism, and the big sort of technology ones. There's cyber risk, attacks on critical national infrastructure, things like that. This year, the top three were around environmental and climate change. The third one was the fact that we're losing biodiversity. Just look at the story around the bumblebee, or the honeybee. Is it the bumblebee? Which one is it? What is the pollinator? The pollinator, the lack of pollinators.
I don't know much about bees.
But the thing is this: if pollinators all die out, what's going to happen to agriculture? So, you know, there is a knock-on effect to business. Now, one of the interesting quotes at this briefing I went to, it was from a guy from Zurich Insurance. And, you know, said, why does an insurance company care about this stuff? You know, insurance, financial services, why do they honestly care about climate change? His reasoning is this: they can no longer create data models that accurately predict when there's going to be a flood, when there's going to be a natural disaster. Mm-hmm. They have no idea now. The models from 20 years ago are no longer valid. And that's a big one. That's a big one for the insurance sector. It's a big one for if you're modelling financial risk. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that for organisations that may have in the past not been too concerned.
Mm.
About climate change, about the pollinators, about environmental risks. You know, they are now taking it seriously. And of course, there's an IT story in this as well. Before the World Economic Forum, the chief executive of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, made an announcement pre-Davos, saying that not only will they reduce their carbon emissions, they will eradicate them. They'll like cut it out of history. So Microsoft's been going since 1975, and by 2050 they want to say reduce every single bit of carbon and turn it around so that they'll be in sort of negative carbon in the sense that they will not have had an impact on society, on the environment. But this raises lots of interesting questions in that, well, how do you do that? I mean, IT sector generally is considered quite a clean energy sector. I'm sure we've covered this in the past, but we know that data centres do use up a lot of electricity. There are some stats, and some people say this is totally wrong, but it might be as big as the airline industry, who knows? But the thing is that every single tweet you make, every single email you send, every time you do something with the mouse on the keyboard that causes electrons to go over the internet to another computer involves lots and lots of little bits of processing.
And
individually that's nothing, but when billions of people are doing it, and billions of people are, there's a huge amount of electricity just being flowing from one place to another every time we interact on the internet.
So IT has a big role to play.
IT has a big role to play.
Since it is a big polluter.
And I think there's a thing that Microsoft said, that it's going to reduce its carbon footprint. I think there's two figures. There's a 2030 it wants to be carbon neutral.
Yeah.
And this raises an interesting question, because we were having a chat about what Simon Quick was talking about the They have a global channel conference.
Yeah, Worldwide Partner Conference.
Partner Conference, there you go. All IT companies, all the big ones have global conferences. They invite people to places like Las Vegas.
And yeah, flying we get invited out to those. We don't get invited to Davos.
And you have to fly yourself out to these places.
Yeah,
and you know, in the case of my dot, it is a global partner conference, and that must be a huge.
Yeah.
I mean, this week we were talking about, you know, what's going on at Davos and how all of these CEOs came in their private jets and how expensive that was, you know, how many of them took the train.
But there is a case for saying that's actually very efficient because they're all coming in the one place, whereas otherwise they would be taking a lot more flights.
Mm. Or the other argument is get the CEO of, or the key techies or chief evangelists, I think is the ones that, you know, these people fly out all this way to go and see a chief evangelist. A chief techie. We'll get the chief techie to come over to the UK more often or visit, do the rounds.
Mm.
I mean, the environment climate change was a massive theme. It was the theme of the World Economic Forum, because Davos is a place, right? It's the conference is in Davos. It was a major, major theme. And of course, they had the big face-off between Greta Thunberg and Donald Trump.
Mm.
I'm sure a lot of world leaders would probably be on the side of Donald Trump. And yeah, so I mean, it was a massive, massive theme this year.
Mm. And Cliff covering it from here means he has. You've got what? Is your participation in Davos then carbon neutral?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
But many other publications do go, including The Economist. I listened to quite an interesting little episode of The Economist podcast. Where they posed the question about Davos, does the world need Davos?
Oh, okay.
It's quite an entertaining episode of theirs. Anne McElvoy is the host of that one. Zanny Minton-Beddoes is the editor of The Economist, also, and Patrick Phillis, and you get some of the inside goss really from the way they talk about it. Like Ivanka Trump walking through and the crowd parting, how it's like a teenage party for all these guys that, you know, they're all insecure and they're all kind of starstruck by each other and things like that. It's quite an entertaining little episode of their thing. But I suppose the serious question for them is it still a relevant thing? Can it keep its mojo, which is the print version of that discussion? Does the world need Davos? And they said yes. In Beddoes' words, it's a good convener. You know, it brings people together. And if it didn't exist, you would have to invent it. That's their argument.
Well, in the e-zine, there's a leader that we're running about this, about Davos, about what needs to be done. I don't think the politicians really want to go forward and say, you know, we're going to make things much more difficult for the man and woman on the street. Higher taxes. We've seen what happens, you know, around the world where you try and reduce, say, you know, make oil more expensive. You know, make diesel more expensive. What's that mean? Well, it means that the poorer people end up having to pay for it. They still need you. Still need your car. You still, you know. We don't have the greatest public transport, but the politicians, I don't think, can solve the problem themselves. All they really want to solve the problem. It's a too difficult a problem.
Yeah. There's clearly a lot of people who go to that event who can pull very big levers.
The idea of CEOs saying, "Well, maybe we can make a difference," and you know, if Microsoft is able to say, "Well, you know, we're a green company. This is what we're doing," maybe other companies will follow. And see it as a not just, oh, it's corporate social responsibility, but this is actually what we believe in. We believe in as an organisation.
Mm.
We believe in saving the planet, and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Dreamforce, because in a sense that has the celebrity people there, as the politicians there, like Obama. You know, it's quite big picture stuff at Dreamforce, and it is a gathering of people, and I'm sure there are a lot of private events that go on at Dreamforce which are a bit, you know, a bit kind of similar to what's happening here. Well, all the great and the good will be coming back from their Swiss mountaintop. inspired and no doubt keen to remake the world. What about us? What have we got coming up in the next few weeks?
Well, there is a sort of season of open source events going on, so okay. I'll be attending the KubeCon conference along with Adrian Bridgewater, who does our open source insider blog. So we'll both be there.
SOS, season of open source.
Season of open source. And if you do look on Adrian's blog, he's doing an interesting series about licensing and the business model, because open source business models are quite difficult. How do you make money from free software? Yeah. Particularly when you've got the likes of AWS and others potentially doing things that sort of take away your revenue stream.
Is that Caroline? Last week was World Caroling. How can you top that?
No, I definitely can't. Not over the next couple of weeks. I'll be in the office a lot more. Doing more IR35 stuff, more loan charge stuff. And also, I think at the end of the next week, we'll probably get the first of the big cloud financial results. I think AWS usually report their Q1 figures at the end of January.
Right.
So there'll be that to look out for as well. So, yes.
I'll be crunching through some case studies, and then as we go into February, Oracle and SAP both have some big events in London, so I'm thinking about preparing for those. Next week we've got Bill Goodwin, our investigations editor, coming on the podcast to recap the TravelX tale.
Oh gosh.
See where he's got to with that. That's all we've got time for today, alas. It just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to our special guest Cliff. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.